Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, in most parts of the world, inequality is shrinking and the middle class is growing. It's what some call the Great Convergence. Then, scientists are finding remarkable similarities between humans and other animals. What might these similarities teach us, both about the human condition and our relationship to the other species? The world is witnessing what our next guest calls a Great Convergence. That is, that inequality is shrinking and the middle class is growing. Joining us in studio is Kishore Mahbubani. He is the dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore and the former ambassador to the United Nations for Singapore. His book is called The Great Convergence, Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World. Kishore Mahbubani, it's great to have you here with us. Let's start with your basic concept that what we're seeing is this convergence of almost like a global society. You think that's a really good thing. For example, economically, we're seeing far less poverty. What are the numbers? How's it manifested?
Well, I think one of the best kept secrets in the world is that the last 20 or 30 years have been among the best 20 or 30 years for the vast majority of the world's population because their lives are improving on so many counts. Firstly, wars are becoming a sunset industry. In the 1950s, 500,000 people a year would die from wars. Now it's less than 30,000. That's a dramatic decrease. Secondly, global poverty is disappearing. One of the few Millennium Development Goals that we will meet is the halving of global poverty by 2015. And the US National Intelligence Council, a relatively conservative body, has predicted that global poverty will be eliminated completely by 2030.
How are they defining global poverty?
The United Nations has a technical definition. I'm not sure whether it's $1 or $1.25 a day.
So but it's still kind of a low figure.
Yeah, but that's amazing. Hundreds of millions of people have been liberated from absolute poverty. But thirdly, and this is the most stunning thing, the number of people joining middle classes in the world is exploding. And just to take Asia alone, right now, the number of people who enjoy middle class living standards in Asia are roughly about 500 million people, which is a large number, you know, still bigger than the population of the United States of America. But that number in 7 years, by 2020, is going to explode to 1.75 billion, an increase of 3.5 times in 7 years. This is a massive upliftment of humanity that we've never experienced before, and that's why I call it the Great Convergence.
A couple of numbers from your book. There are still 2.5 billion people out of 7 who don't have access to even a toilet, and even more who are without clean cooking facilities. Mm. So we do still have a very large chunk of people who don't have the fundamental basics.
By the way, when I grew up as a child in Singapore, we didn't have a flush toilet in our house. The per capita income was the same as Ghana, and I was put in a special feeding program when I was young. Now, I mentioned that because Singapore was a typical third world state. Now, Singapore's per capita income is higher than that of the United Kingdom. And we're doing much better than UK in many ways. So the fact that Singapore could go from a typical third world developing country to becoming a modern first world developed country in my lifetime is amazing. But now that feat is being repeated many times over all over Asia.
There's some other sections of your book, when you put them together, bring up a paradox. And that is the more people that we bring into the middle class, and having 7 billion people on the planet, the more we have a sustainability problem. Can the planet Earth sustain 7 billion people who have all of the comforts of middle class? How do we deal with this?
Clearly, that's a huge challenge. And I think we have to think about it now because, you know, more and more people in the world will want to have electricity in their homes, television sets, cars. And so clearly energy consumption will go up, global greenhouse gas emissions will go up, and we need to do something about it. But the only way to do something about it is to find an equitable mathematical formula. And as the Prime Minister of India says, and I think I quote him in my book, he says, you can't expect me to deprive 400 million Indians of electricity just so that Americans can keep on driving their SUVs. So come on, if America is the richest country, doesn't take the lead in promoting the notion of sacrifice, how can you expect the poorer countries to make a sacrifice? And that's exactly why Copenhagen broke down some years ago, because sadly, President Obama was calling on the poorer countries to make a compromise, but the United States Congress had tied his hands and refused to give him any room for negotiation.
There are voices in the American public sphere that argue the exact opposite. And it's part of what you talk about in this book, The Great Convergence, where we are all thinking about our own state issues and not thinking as a global community. And you point out that three former heads of state have addressed this issue and talked about the global community and how we need to look at these things as a planet, not as individual states. Mm. And yet while they're heads of state, they can't do it.
Yes. In fact, I begin the book with a very simple metaphor to explain how the world has changed. I say that before, when 7 billion people lived in 193 separate countries, it was like they were living in 193 separate boats with captains and crews taking care of each boat and rules to make sure the boats didn't collide. That was the pre-globalization world. But today, with the world having shrunk, the 7 billion people no longer live in 193 separate boats. They live in 193 separate cabins on the same boat. But you have captains and crews taking care of each cabin, but no captain or crew taking care of the global boat as a whole. And that explains all the problems we are having in terms of global financial crisis, in terms of global warming, in terms of pandemics and global terrorism and so on and so forth. So that's why I quote Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, Al Gore, all of whom said, hey, we're now living on the same boat. We must now come together. But as you mentioned earlier, the paradox is that what seems so obvious to them, after they left office, they couldn't say while they were in office. And that's the tragedy of democratic politics.
Now, part of your argument is what we're missing is a one-world theory, really a theory that leaders can sell to their electorate that would allow them to then participate in these global agreements. What might one look like?
The good news for us is that the world as a whole is becoming a better and better place. More peaceful, less poverty, more prosperous. So the global trends are going in the right direction. So it makes it easier for us to come together and cooperate. Now, frankly, China and India have actually announced they're prepared to make some sacrifices in their development to prevent global warming. Now, that's a remarkable concession from relatively poor countries. So if you can get the richer countries to do the same, and to be fair, the Europeans are doing it. It's only the United States of America where it is impossible politically for the U.S. Congress to make any kind of concessions to reduce global warming. That's why the heart of the problem lies here in the United States.
It's also another paradox. You wrote about this in your book, The Great Convergence, where here the United States has been the home of a very robust environmental movement. And yet here it is China that is acknowledging climate change and prepared to do something about it. How do we explain this?
You're right. This is a major paradox. And I say somewhat mischievously in the book that perhaps Al Gore, as a symbolic gesture, should announce that he has to return the Nobel Peace Prize because he has failed in his mission of trying to persuade the American public and the American government to make sacrifices to take care of global warming.
You said that China is also developing a vast NGO network that has never been in existence before, and many of these are environmental organizations. What is the impact of this? And is this something that has arisen from the Great Convergence?
China has gone through many dramatic transformations. I mean, when I went to China for the first time in 1980, China was a completely regimented society. There were no skyscrapers in the cities, no billboards, no cars. People were just driving bicycles and people wore Maoist suits. It went from a very tightly regimented society in 1980 to a society that when you go down there, looks as open as America in many ways. When you go to the universities, you can discuss anything you want. And amazingly enough, you have various NGOs that have come up that are now quite critical of many of the government's policies. And in fact, the one new political reality that the Chinese Communist Party has to deal with is NGOs who are watching their policies and saying, hey, you're destroying the environment. We have to do something about it.
Another aspect that you mentioned was that a media is starting to develop that is challenging the government at various times. The example you gave in the book was a train crash. In the past, the government might have been able to push it under the covers, but that didn't occur. What happened?
Well, I think in this major train crash, the government tried to go back to its old impulses, which is to pretend that no major disaster had happened. And they almost literally, not metaphorically, tried to bury the evidence. And there was a huge outcry, public outcry, and the government had to stop doing so. Remember, many years, many decades ago, when China had a major earthquake, when Chairman Mao Zedong announced there would be no publicity about the earthquake, the government had to comply. So an entire earthquake was not reported in China. Today, when one train gets involved in a crash, the whole country gets to know about it. That's how China has opened up.
Now, is this also a result of the great convergence you write about because of the technological advances that are occurring?
Yes. In fact, the number one language that is used on the internet today is not English, but is Mandarin. Because there are more Chinese internet websites than there are English-speaking websites. So it has become, in that sense, a much more open society. I must emphasize, the government does try to block information flows, cut information flows, but it's very difficult in the world of today.
It seems that this global community that's starting to emerge, as opposed to disparate groups, disparate states, is primarily a result of information and the technology, peer-to-peer media, as well as international media that are allowing people to learn about each other and about different societies and call together perhaps the most eclectic best practices.
In my previous book, The New Asian Hemisphere, I tried to explain why the Asian societies, which have been dormant for two centuries or so, why have they suddenly sprung back to life? And I say the reason why they did so is that they were finally understood, absorbed, and are implementing pillars of Western wisdom, including mastery of science and technology, a culture of pragmatism, meritocracy, a culture of peace, rule of law, and of course, education. But in this new book, I push the argument a bit further. And I say there's a new consensual cluster of norms are emerging in the world. And that results in these countries succeeding and developing. And one of them, for example, is the spread of reason and logic. Governments today, in most places, are beginning to understand how to develop societies. And to give you a simple example, like encouraging people to wash their hands improves hygiene dramatically. And guess what? It leads to less babies dying. So it's simple best practices that are now spreading all over the world and are saving millions of lives.
Is there also a downside? I wonder about the spreading of norms that might not be so productive. The spreading of corrupt practices, for example. Mm. And this ties back into the idea that in some places we're seeing, as you've noted, that the very poor people are rising and joining the middle class. Whereas in other places like the U.S., the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, and corruption in some cases being rewarded or at least forgiven in very public ways.
Yeah. I must emphasize that I don't claim that the world has reached nirvana yet. I mean, global poverty will not be eliminated in the next 2-3 years. It will be eliminated by 2030. But to look at the world through the eyes of the majority of the world's population, especially the 88% of the world's population that lives outside the West. Now, the population who live in the West have had a bad decade. Since 2008, 2009 financial crisis, things have been very difficult in Europe, things have been very difficult in America. But from the point of view of the majority of the world's population, the 3.5 billion who live in Asia, a billion who live in Africa, the 500 over million who live in Latin America, the last two decades have been wonderful. 6 of the 10 fastest growing economies in the past decade have come from Africa. There have been dramatic improvements. Just to give you one statistic, in 1990, there were zero cell phones in India. Zero. But by 2012, that number had grown to 750 million in 2 decades. Now that's a remarkable achievement. And a cell phone, by the way, is not just something that is used for bilateral conversations. It also connects people to the modern world, gives them access to information that they couldn't have before. All these little things have improved their lives dramatically.
You noted Africa. It seems when you look at it through the eyes of mass media that Africa is actually suffering quite a bit, particularly with all of the political violence. Can we really say that things are better in Africa?
Well, if you ask the Africans, they will tell you that things are getting much better in Africa. Our views on the world are conditioned by what we see on television. So we see the violence in Syria, we see the violence in Mali, we see the problems in Sudan, we say, oh, the world is falling apart. But statistically, the number of people who are experiencing violence, especially interstate conflict, is the lowest it has ever been.
Do you think that the emphasis from the statistics is that it's interstate conflict, meaning state, versus the internal conflict? The internal conflict seemed pretty awful.
Most people believe that while people dying from interstate conflict is going down, people dying from intrastate conflicts are going up. And that's not true either. Again, the data is very clear. Of course, there are some countries where conflicts carry on. I mean, this is a fact. Afghanistan is clearly still at war. Somalia still has conflict. Of course, there are problem cases. But, you know, you don't judge the health of a population at large by looking at the people with the worst health. You look at the average throughout the society and the average levels of violence in every dimension, interstate, intrastate, and even domestic violence is going down.
You mentioned also that education is on the rise in these parts of the world.
One of the best things that's happening in the world today is the spread of modern education. And as you know, that's also liberating women. Some of the most stunning statistics I provide come from Iran, where 65% of undergraduate enrollment in Iran is by women in the science area. So much so that the Iranian government had to cut down the number of females going to universities because they were shocked at the number going up. So you can see all over the world, education is spreading. And in China, as recently as 1993, only 5% of each cohort went to university. Now that number has grown to 23%. Again, that's in 20 years. The world at large is becoming better and better educated. And that's one of the reasons why the world is becoming more peaceful. That's also another reason why the world is becoming more healthy.
Now, do you see in this convergence that while the rest of the world is coming up, that the United States might be dipping?
Both the United States and EU, as you know, are going through a rough time. Even if you slide backwards, your quality of life is still much better than that of most people in the developing world. Now, America has got some unique problems now. One of them clearly is rising inequality. That's a challenge it has to deal with. The other challenge, which has come as a shock to the whole world, is the political paralysis in America. And when you watch the debate over sequestration, the incapacity to bust budgets, believe me, this has really shocked the rest of the world. Because in the past, they assume that if they wanted to look for a role model of a democracy that they should copy and emulate, they assumed that America had the best democracy in the world. Today, watching what is going on down here, I can tell you very few countries want to copy American democracy. Their view is something has gone wrong here. We must make sure we do not do what Americans are doing.
You talked about that one of the important norms was the rule of law. Most people would agree that the rule of law is a very important thing, except for, of course, when the rule of law is very unjust, which we have seen periodically throughout societies, particularly in discriminatory societies or when they support things like slavery or discrimination.
What I mean by the rule of law, see, Americans take it for granted. I mean, America has one of the best rule of law conditions of any society anywhere in the world, frankly. But the rest of the world has got a long way to catch up in this area. But the good news is that they are moving in the right direction. Because in the past, especially if you live, let's say, in the Arab world, you took it for granted that the rulers had a right to rule and you had to be governed and accept their rules. But as you know, the Arab Spring demonstrated that four rulers who have been ruling for over 150 years, Mubarak, Ben Ali, Gaddafi, the president of Yemen, suddenly disappeared within a year. Why? Because people no longer accept rule by law. They want rule of law. The difference between rule by law and rule by law means the ruler decides and you obey. Rule of law means that there are laws in which not just the people have to comply with, but the rulers have to comply with. And that's a dramatic revolution. And by the way, this is something that China hasn't achieved yet. Because in China, you still have, in many cases, rule by law, because the Chinese Communist Party still remains above the rule of law. And that's going to be China's biggest challenge. The Chinese Communist Party also have it comply with the same rule of law as the people. And that will take a decade or two, but that's something they have to do.
Where else do you see that as a problem?
If you take a country like Indonesia, which, by the way, is a large country, 240 million people, the fourth most populous country, for a long time when President Suharto was running it, you had ruled by law. He and his family were above the law. But today, the president of Indonesia is not above the law. There's a free media, there's an independent courts, and very powerful people are now have to go to court to defend themselves. And even in Pakistan, which, as you know, people believe might become a failed state, the Chief Justice could sack the president. Now, that's a remarkable step forward.
The other paradox that you also point out is while the U.S. has this rule of law domestically, we have problems with the rule of law internationally. Hmm. And, of course, again, the book being called The Great Convergence, thinking in terms of a global society rather than as individual disparate states. Hmm. How does that fare with what's happening as a global society?
The tragedy here is that the United States, as I said earlier, has got the best rule of law at home. And yet the United States has become one of the greatest violators of international law. I mean, conducting a war illegally in Iraq, as Kofi Annan said, and not ratifying treaties and conventions like the Law of the Sea Convention, virtually every other state had ratified. And this is something that Americans have got to wake up to and realize that this is no longer in America's national interest to do so, which is why I begin the book by quoting from a speech that President Bill Clinton gave in Yale in 2003, where he said, if America assumes it'll be number one forever, then fine. We should carry on doing what we're doing. It doesn't matter what the rest of the world thinks. But if we can conceive of the possibility that we'll no longer be number one, surely it's in America's interest to create a rules-based order that will constrain the next number one. He didn't mention names, but obviously he's talking about China. So if you want China to emerge as a law-abiding, rules-based superpower, then America should show the way, and America should lead the way by complying with international law.
If we are all converging, and if we are becoming a global community, how do we start to function as a global community, which some people might not like, by the way?
The world, to use another metaphor, is also becoming a global village. And if you live in a village, as you know, you must have a village council to mediate in disputes, to pick up the garbage, to ensure that the streetlights come on, and so on and so forth. In the same way, as we are becoming a global village, we need to also have stronger global village councils. If you start creating them from scratch, it's a mission impossible. It's almost impossible to start new organizations. But the good news is that you have organizations like the United Nations, which were inspired by American ideals, produced by American statesmen, as you know, at the end of World War II. So the United Nations is essentially an American creation, which many Americans have forgotten. So why not try to strengthen and revive the United Nations and its sister organizations? If you live in a global village and if you're worried about a global pandemic, then what you should do right now is strengthen the World Health Organization. But sadly, it has been American national policy to weaken the United Nations and to weaken World Health Organization, to weaken the International Atomic Energy Agency. And what I say is that in this new world, it is time for the United States State Department to switch off its autopilot mechanism and review its old policies and now work on strengthening rather than weakening multilateral organizations.
And it sounds like to perhaps even stop dominating them.
The United States will always be powerful. Even if it becomes number two, it will remain one of the most powerful countries in the world. Given its sheer power, it will continue to dominate the world in one way or another. But what the United States can do now is to use its strength and its dominance to create a more cooperative world order, which will be more comfortable both for the United States and for other countries in the world. I'm not appealing to American idealism, to American altruism. I'm appealing to American self-interest to say, hey, it is now in your self-interest to strengthen these organizations.
There were a few aspects of these international organizations and the United States engagement that you pointed out. I think you call them barriers to convergence. The OECD, Afghanistan, the IMF, and the corrupt aid process. Perhaps you can give us a little thumbnail sketch of each of these and how you see them as barriers to this global community.
Yeah. One of the most ironic barriers to convergence is the belief in the West that the Western nations are the most generous nations in the world, and they believe they are the most generous because they give a lot of foreign aid to the rest of the world. And I think very few Americans know that even by OECD standards, America is one of the least generous nations among the OECD in terms of percentage of GNP that it gives out. And for every dollar that the United States gives out, 80 cents comes back to the United States and 20 cents goes to the recipient. So this is why I say, ironically, at a time when America is facing huge budgetary problems, many thoughtful, well-intentioned Americans may want to preserve America's foreign aid budget because they want to help the rest of the world. Actually, if America stops giving foreign aid, the world will not even notice it because it has very little impact on the rest of the world.
But some countries would notice it.
The two countries, I think, if I'm not mistaken, that receive the most amount of U.S. foreign aid are Israel and Egypt. And the rest of the world receives very little. And believe me, today, countries have finding other ways and means of developing. And much of American foreign aid, actually, and this has been documented by many authors, has a distorting effect on countries. And it actually doesn't help the country's development. So to use an old mantra, trade, not aid, is the answer.
You talked a bit about the geopolitical issues and some of the other clashes that are creating problems in our global village. One of them was the West and Islam. How do you see that being resolved?
Most people, when they read my book, think I'm a woolly-headed idealist. Actually, I've represented a very tough, realistic, pragmatic country like Singapore for 33 years. So I'm a hard-headed international realist. And I actually recognize that there are geopolitical challenges in the world that have to be overcome. But the good news I have is that they can all be overcome. And certainly in the case of Islam in the West, I see no necessary reason why there should be any kind of clash of civilizations, because most Muslim societies are modernizing and opening up themselves. I also suggest that there is a simple silver bullet that is available to reduce the tension between Islam and West, and that is, of course, a two-state solution between Israel and Palestine. It is in America's interest, in Israel's interest, in the interest of the Palestinians to work towards a two-state solution, and the best time to do it is now, and that will lead to also a reduction in tension between Islam and the West.
We've been speaking with Kishore Mahbubani. His book is called The Great Convergence, Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World. Thank you so much. When we come back, like humans, animals get depression, addictions, eating disorders, and engage in many related behaviors. What can we learn from animals about the human condition? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. Scientists are increasingly finding similarities between humans and other animals. Other animals cooperate, communicate, spread culture, and experience a wide spectrum of emotions, including empathy, joy, and jealousy. They are also similarly affected by disorders like addiction, depression, food disorders, and self-harm, which were once thought to be found only in humans. Just how similar are we to other animals? And what might these findings teach us about the human condition and our relationship to other species? With us is Barbara Natterson-Horowitz. She is a cardiologist, the director of imaging at the UCLA Cardiac Arrhythmia Center, and a cardiac consultant for the Los Angeles Zoo. She's co-author of Zubiquity, The Astonishing Connection Between Human and Animal Health. Mark Beckhoff is professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and his books include The Emotional Lives of Animals, Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed, The Fascinating Science of Animal Intelligence, Emotions, Friendship, and Conservation, and co-author of Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals. Stan Kujai is also with us. He is director of the Marine Mammal Behavior and Cognition Laboratory at the University of Southern Mississippi. He's co-author of The Emotions of Animals and Humans, Comparative Perspectives. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. I'd like to start with Barbara Natterson-Horowitz. In your book, Zubiquity, you found remarkable similarity between animals and human health and disease. Some of the things that were most fascinating were the behavioral and mental similarities. Depression, addiction, grieving, food disorders. Just how similar would you say humans and animals really are in these areas?
Well, I'm a physician, as you said, and like most physicians, my training didn't include anything comparative. And so until I started doing research for this project, I really was not aware that animals suffer from everything from breast cancer and Crohn's disease, brain tumors, congestive heart failure, that the overlap between human and animal pathology is very significant. But what was perhaps the most interesting and illuminating aspect of the research was to learn about comparative psychopathology, the overlap in mental disorders between humans and many animals. In general, the broad categories of psychiatric disturbances that we see in human beings, we also see in a variety of animal species, including anxiety disorders, compulsive disorders, as you mentioned, disorders involved with dysregulated eating behavior, even such things as self-injury, which I had, as a physician, always assumed to be uniquely human. But of course, I was wrong.
Why don't we talk about a couple of those examples, perhaps starting with self-injury?
Well, there are several characteristic forms of self-injury that we see in human patients. Probably the most iconic is cutting, which is a real paradox, because when you ask a human patient, you know, why they're doing this, they actually tell you that it causes them to feel calm. It gives them relief and release. And this is interesting, I think, to sort of turn to the animal case and look at animals who self-injure and ask veterinarians and wildlife biologists why they're doing that. And one of the hypotheses that I have is that grooming, which of course is soothing to all species, can be amplified and turn into self-injury. We see that in human patients, and I wonder whether that's the same thing that we might be seeing in animal patients.
Mark Beckhoff.
Everything Barbara said, I would agree with. As an ecologist and evolutionary biologist, I'm much a fan of Charles Darwin's ideas about evolutionary continuity, which says basically the differences among animals are differences in degree rather than differences in kind. So, you know, all biomedical research and a lot of comparative behavioral research really centers on that. And the bumper sticker there would be, if we have something, they do too. In terms of the psychopathologies in non-human animals, there's a lot of work being done now on captive animals, chimpanzees, elephants, dogs, suffering from PTSD due to the horrific conditions in which they're kept. And there's also some evidence in the field. I studied coyotes for a decade years ago in the Grand Teton National Park, and I remember seeing an animal who I would have called a bipolar wolf or an autistic coyote. I think in the wild what happens, though, is often these animals just don't survive. So I like to think that, you know, it's rare, but the cases that I know of extreme psychological disorders really do come from animals in various forms of captivity.
Mark Beckhoff, your work also suggests that animals, like humans, also experience things like empathy, cooperation. They have codes of morality, fairness. Where do we see these behaviors?
Well, we certainly see them in social mammals, And there's just been some really fascinating work done on fish showing cooperative hunting. There's been a recent study published of fish using their head to signal where food is. We call that referential or gestural communication, thought to be only in humans and then non-human primates and now fish. But really the best cases come from mammals, where we see joy, you know, great joy, deep grief and sorrow, resentment, embarrassment, jealousy, all these psychological states, if you will, and emotions are being, you know, studied in a whole lot of different species, and we're finding them in ample numbers.
Stan Kujai, you also have found some of these aspects in your work. How would you compare it?
Well, we're definitely interested in emotions in non-human animals, especially cetaceans, the species we study the most, but also elephants and other species. I guess I would be a little bit more cautious than Mark because I do think that animals have emotions. I think it's very difficult to assess them. And so we certainly see things that look like grieving, and I would describe them as grieving. It's just hard to, if the grieving that we're talking about, how similar it is to human grieving, for example. Mark mentioned joy. One of our research emphasis is on animal play. I know Mark has done a tremendous amount of work on that as well. And I certainly interpret playful behavior as joyful, and I certainly think the animals find it pleasurable. At least I hope they do. But again, it's that comparison to human emotions, which I think is the scientific quandary. How similar are they to human emotions and how different are they? As Mark noted, we believe there's a continuity involved between among various species, but is it a fuzzy boundary? Is it a distinct boundary? Is there no boundary? And I think you could find arguments in literature for all of those positions. One of the things we're interested in dolphins is how they read the emotional states of other dolphins. We think that's really important. They're very social, and being social animals, they need to understand how other animals are feeling in order to determine how to best interact with them. And we think they're good at that, but we don't have much of an idea about how they do that. Probably has something to do with acoustics, the sounds that the other animals make. It may be that they use echolocation to get a sense for muscle tension and heart rate and things like that to read emotional state. So to me, it's a fascinating field. It's one that really hasn't been studied that long in animals. And I should acknowledge that Mark's one of the leaders in that field. So I want to thank him for helping guide us along that way.
Thanks.
It's only recently that comparative biologists and psychologists have even dared to say words like personality and emotions when talking about animals. And I think it's made the field not just richer, but also more theoretically sound to acknowledge the fact that animals do have personalities, that they do experience emotions. And even though they're messy things to talk about,
I would take a different point of view. I mean, I agree a lot with what Stan said. I would say that we don't need to use humans as a template. I mean,
oh, I agree.
Dog joy may be different from chimpanzee joy. There's wonderful research by a neuroscientist named Jaak Panksepp who looked at laughing and tickling and joy in rats. And these papers were published in Science magazine, you know, where most of my colleagues would like to publish one paper in their lifetime. And the reason I say that is because they're not just, you know, sort of folk tales. They're not stories in Time magazine. And Jaak found that rats like to be tickled. He's done the neurobiology of it. And it's really very solid work. Frankly, I would say it's impossible to question whether two dogs running around playing with one another are not feeling dog joy. There's been recent work done on depression in bees, very high-end research showing, in fact, that they show the same neural changes as do humans when we become depressed and pessimistic. So my answer would be, I don't think we need to use humans as a measuring stick. And I think that, you know, once again, it's hard to do the experiments. But a lot of field work, I mean, watching coyotes and wolves in the wild, there's so much evidence that they have what we call theories of behavior and theories of mind. And just because we may not be very good at certain things, I think one could easily argue very compellingly that there's reasons why certainly wild animals would have to be very good at these sorts of cognitive skills.
Barbara Natterson-Horowitz, we've been talking about depression, we've talked about grieving. How similar have you found the animal kingdom?
As I'm hearing this discussion, I've been thinking, well, what are the common mechanisms? The question is sort of, you know, are the experiences the same? That's one question. And the second question is, if they are at least similar, is that driven by highly conserved neurophysiological systems? And one of the most interesting perspectives is to look at pleasure, at why perhaps animals and non-human animals are rewarded with fitness-promoting behaviors with pleasure. So we get pleasure from eating, and animals seem to get pleasure from eating, sex, certain substances, and so on. There's a wonderful book called The Compass of Pleasure by David Linden from Johns Hopkins, who writes about this. And I think one of the ways of thinking about the commonality of experience between humans and non-human animals is to consider, from an evolutionary perspective, this phenomenon of pleasure.
You mentioned the neurological perspective. There's been considerable new work looking at the brain. How do these fit in?
There's lots of different ways to look at this. I think one very fascinating piece of literature from the human side is to look at the benefits to human beings when they're around animals. So just the simple act of petting a dog for a patient in the hospital or just a, you know, someone in their home has the effect of increasing heart rate variability, which is a marker of sort of the health of the autonomic nervous system. And what's interesting is as human pets a dog, the heart rate variability of the groomee, that would be the animal, improves, as does the HRV of the petter. And this connects, I think, to questions of mirror neurons and all kinds of really only partially explored areas.
Let's go back to Mark Beckoff. You've written about this sense of compassion. You've talked about primary versus secondary emotions. What examples can you give us about these acts of compassion or empathy, and where does that fall in terms of the level of emotion?
There's lots of good examples of animals, you know, wild animals, but there's a lab study done at the University of Chicago. The first study was done showed that rats would help free up a restrained rat, and they did all the necessary work, I think, and they described it as being due to empathy. And they then gave the rats choice of freeing up a restrained rat or eating chocolate, and they preferred to free the rat over eating chocolate. And I'm not sure I know a lot of humans who would do that. But also empathy in chickens, and these are all, once again, published in peer-reviewed journals. So I think that when we see a behavioral phenomenon to which we would put the label empathy, and I think what Barbara's saying is true, you know, you have to look at the neuroarchitecture, you can look a lot at the neurophysiology, but when you see the similarities there, then it just seems to me that we are seeing similar phenomena. I don't know how the rat feels directly when he or she frees another rat, but it could still be driven by the same emotion. I've seen wild elephants in Africa helping one another in situations where the elephant who is being helped would die without that aid. And when I wrote about some of these observations, you know, some people said, well, there must be some reason the injured elephant must be able to do something for those who are helping her. But the fact of the matter is, one of these cases went on for 15 years, and without being surrounded by and being fed by other elephants in a group, this elephant would be prey in a heartbeat.
You are listening to The Scholar's Circle, scholarscircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the similarities and differences between humans and other animals. Stan Kuchai, what is your research showing us about culture and cooperation among animals?
Well, dolphins are incredibly cooperative. I think that we see that in terms of foraging and protection from predators and so on with wild animals. It's been a little bit difficult to demonstrate in a laboratory-type setting with dolphins, but I suspect that's mainly because we haven't found a task which is interesting enough for them to want to cooperate on. And honestly, I mean, we know they can cooperate. It's just been hard to show it in a more controlled setting. I guess the thing that I'm more interested in is, you know, how young dolphins learn to communicate, how they learn to, for example, read other dolphins' emotions, how they learn to be members of their group. And so that's where the cultural transmission comes in. And one thing that dolphins are really good at is observational learning. And Gav spent a lot of time watching other dolphins and exploring the world on their own and or with other dolphins. We have found that personality plays a big role in that. Some calves are bolder than other calves, and they typically lead the way, and they're the ones, the more sophisticated forms of play and sort of challenge themselves more, and the more cautious calves follow in their, I was going to say footpaths, but let's say
their fin pads.
So one thing we have found with dolphins, which we'd find in lots of species, is that not all models are equally salient. So, for example, there are some calves which lead the way. Not necessarily because they're the bold calves, but oftentimes they are, at least in terms of play. And so they're the ones that provide the models for the other calves. Some calves may be engaging in certain behaviors or interacting with an object or other dolphins. One of the things that, again, that is really striking about dolphins, not to put them on a pedestal at all, but the fact that I think that they do learn a lot from one another, and we're just trying to figure out exactly how they do that and how calves do that. We have learned that sometimes, you know, male dolphins actually participate in the rearing of calves. And that's something that hasn't been seen very often. But so just assume that they had their fun and left and didn't ever do any parenting. But now we know that there are some exceptions to that rule. And given how little we actually know about dolphins and how many dolphins are out there, there may be more exceptions than we know of.
Mark Beckoff?
What Stan said at the beginning, that you know they cooperate, but it's hard to demonstrate in the lab or in captive animals. That's exactly the point I was making before about animals having a theory of behavior, you know, predicting what other animals will do in a certain situation, or a theory of mind, understanding what other animals are feeling. A lot of the experiments that are done in captivity involve humans hiding food or humans doing certain things and then seeing what animals such as, you know, say chimpanzees know. And some of them come up with negative results, and then people say, well, clearly these even great apes don't have a theory of mind. I think that there may be things that are intractable in captivity. A very famous primate researcher told me once that one of the reasons he thinks people get negative results on certain sorts of studies in captivity is the animals are bored. And he wasn't being facetious. He was saying he just really thinks that they just tune out. So, you know, once again, when I've watched packs of wolves or coyotes, it seems impossible for me to explain the high degree of coordination and cooperation if they didn't say, well, Stan is likely to do a certain thing in a certain situation. Animals have these temperaments, personalities, predictable behavior patterns, or, well, it may be based on what they assume he's feeling. So I'm going to keep the door open on that because I think there's still a lot of natural behavior that begs for a more reductionist explanation, because these animals have very complex social lives, and I don't think you can just jam them into predictable stimulus-response type of paradigms.
You mentioned boredom, and that is something that Barbara Natterson-Horowitz has also written about. What about boredom?
One of the interesting outcomes from research about self-injury in animals, particularly in horses, and it was primarily from stallions, is that horses that begin to flank bite and do other kind of stereotypic forms of self-injury typically are felt to be bored or isolated. The interventions are directed at reversing that, so creating a more enriched environment. In some instances, and this is less about boredom and more about isolation, placing another animal in close proximity to the horse, not necessarily another horse, even a little chicken, for example, seems to help. But the fact of boredom being a risk factor for self-injury, I think actually connects to the human side. If you look at human patients who do a lot of self-injury, one group of individuals are prisoners, and the more serious forms of self-injury are actually seen in prisoners in solitary confinement. Again, a very bored population.
Stan Kujai, you've also looked at intelligence, particularly, again, in dolphins. You looked at their ability to plan.
Looking both at work that has been done in captivity and observation in the wild, it's clear that they plan. The fact they can cooperate in the wild, I think, requires planning. And the fact that they can demonstrate planning in these artificial tasks that we set up in captivity shows that they have very flexible problem-solving skills in this area. So I also like to go back to the boredom thing and relate that to intelligence and self-injury as well. I do think that the idea that lots of animals in captivity that do self-injuries are bored is spot on. And one of the things that we've noticed in dolphins is that dolphin calves typically make their play more and more complex. So they start off doing something, then they get really good at it, and then they make it more difficult, and they make it more difficult, and so on. And I think part of that is because that way the play doesn't become boring. But the other part of that is I think they're challenging themselves. And so that what they're doing is they're doing, in a playful context, something that, you know, they have some control over, they're nonetheless setting up situations in which they're sort of driving their own cognitive development. And so we think that dolphin play is actually really serious in the sense that it facilitates these flexible problem-solving skills that we see in captivity and in the wild.
Mark Beckoff?
I tend to not use the word intelligent or smart because they're loaded terms. I think of adaptation. I think of the way in which animals are so good at changing their behavior in varying situations. And one of the theories we put forth about play was that play is training for the unexpected. And we think the flexibility comes from play, where they just string behavior patterns randomly. So some people would cast that out as intelligence, and I suppose it is, but I just like to be careful. But I'm astounded at how fast coyotes and wolves and a lot of animals, a lot of birds, can adapt to changing environmental or social conditions, just literally on the run or on the fly. So I think there's something smart going on there, if you will.
So there's two last directions I'd like to go in here. One is really, ultimately, what are we learning with this comparative study, both for the human condition, but also how we treat animals? Barbara Natterson Horowitz, you've been looking at this primarily from the human condition because you're a doctor.
I have to say that throughout my early education, college and beyond, I experienced this kind of recurring firm admonition against anthropomorphizing. To anthropomorphize was sort of an intellectual crime. It was soft. It was projection. And without really realizing it, I think it inhibited my willingness to see connections between human and non-human animals when they were there. On the other end of the spectrum, of course, we want to have the appropriate scientific skepticism and go through the scientific method. But that said, one of the really important takeaways for human patients who are suffering from a spectrum of psychiatric illnesses when it comes to comparative psychopathology is that they're not alone, that these conditions are not uniquely human. And by the way, many of these conditions are highly stigmatized. Psychiatric disorders like self-injury, addiction, even depression and anxiety disorder, compulsions, patients who suffer from these, many of them never get care. They are embarrassed in certain cultures. It is highly stigmatized to have a psychiatric condition. I think simply pointing out that these conditions are not uniquely human has the potential to reduce stigma and actually improve access to care for some patients.
Mark Beckoff?
Barbara went into the notion of anthropomorphism, and I've written many times that we should just put that aside. I don't allow my students to talk about it anymore because we're all necessarily anthropomorphic, using the language we know to just talk about other animals. We need to be careful. But a lot of the critics who say you're just being anthropomorphic are playing a double-edged sword, because I was in a situation once where I said, oh, that elephant, look at that lone elephant in a cage in a zoo. She looks really unhappy. And the guy with me said, oh, you're being anthropomorphic. She's happy. And then it got really quiet. And I got really quiet because to say another animal is happy would be anthropomorphic, too. I do feel what we're learning now can all be used on the animal's behalf. We learn about psychological disorders, PTSD, anxiety, for example, and we know that animals oftentimes in captivity are just, you know, running on empty because they're so stressed. So my take is we need to treat animals much better than we do. And we've got all the science in the world to do it. And I think one of the most egregious oversights is that in the United States Federal Animal Welfare Act, it's right out of the act. It says that they have redefined the word animal to exclude mice of the genus moose and rats of the genus ratus and birds and fish. No one's making that up. So, you know, we know they're animals. We also know that rats and mice and chickens, for example, display empathy. So we have had these data for quite a long time, and they have not been incorporated into any federal legislation. So I always tell people, you know, we're not just putting stories out there. The hard science demands that we incorporate what we know into regulations on how animals are treated and that we can do much better than we are now.
Stan Kuchai.
I have to agree with what everybody has said so far. I do want to go back to one thing that Mark said earlier about intelligence. I have to agree. I think using that word gets us in a little bit of trouble. So when I get asked, how smart are dolphins, my typical response is that that's just not a good question. The better question is, how are dolphins smart? That's sort of what we need to be looking at. When we look at, you know, other animals' behaviors, as Mark said earlier, instead of trying to equate them to humans, just try to define them on their own terms. In terms of what we're learning, I think in addition to helping us learn hopefully a little bit about ourselves, One thing that we could do is we need to learn not just how to conserve animals in the wild, and we're a long way from knowing how to do that. If you just look at the evidence for coming extinctions, one thing that we're not doing a good job at, and we could do a much better job at, is making animals in captivity's lives as good as they can be. And I know that that's very controversial, but if we're going to have animals in captivity, and regardless of species, we're obligated to do what we can, knowing what we know about the species, for them to be, I know Mark doesn't like this, doesn't think this word is too wishy-washy, but to ensure that they have the best lives that they can, that their welfare is being taken care of. And I agree with Mark, I don't think we're doing that.
Mark Beckoff, I really like what Stan said about how are animals smart, because I study dogs among other animals. People will say, are cats smarter than dogs? And I always will say, well, that's just not a really biologically meaningful question, that animals do what they need to do to be card-carrying members of their species. There's lots of things that mice can do that chimpanzees can't do. When a chimpanzee does something that a mouse or a bird can't do, people will say, oh, look how smart that chimpanzee is. But when these New Caledonian crows, you know, make and use more sophisticated tools than chimpanzees, no one says the birds are smarter. Stan hit it right on the head, because if you say, how are animals smart, you can cash that out, you know, into an argument about adaptation. That's great.
Thank you so much for being with us, Mark Beckoff, Barbara Natterson-Horowitz, and Stan Kujai. So appreciate your research and your thoughts and your willingness to share it with us.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Barbara Natterson-Horowitz is a cardiologist, the director of imaging at the UCLA Cardiac Arrhythmia Center, and a cardiac consultant for the Los Angeles Zoo. She's co-author of Zoobiquity, The Astonishing Connection Between Human and Animal Health. Mark Beckoff is professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and his books include The Emotional Lives of Animals, Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed, and The Fascinating Science of Animal Intelligence, Emotions, Friendship, and Conservation. Stan Kujai is director of the Marine Mammal Behavior and Cognition Laboratory at the University of Southern Mississippi. He's co-author of The Emotions of Animals and Humans, Comparative Perspectives. Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Cuauhtemoc Aleman, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Armudian. See you next week.